Going up?
Yes, we are. We are going up, and they are going down. We just have to get our affairs in order, tell all the little boys what to do. 1, 2, 3. Yippee-yee.
Hi, and welcome to Hierarchy of Disagreement. My name is Jason, and I say, let's let the now destroy the forever. I'm joined here by Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
Hi, and also Doug. Hey, Doug.
Hey.
So, we are just here to talk about the wonderful, strange movie Megalopolis, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And we just had to talk about this movie because it's such a marvel. It's such a unique gem, standing alone in the desert of Marvel movies, you know?
I'm pretty sure after they made this movie, they're just going to stop making all movies because this, I mean, it really broke the mold for perfection.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely in a class of its own.
So this movie, I didn't know a whole lot about this movie, except it's Francis Ford Coppola, who's got a good pedigree for making good movies. And he was aiming for the fences when he made, I mean, I think I saw the trailer, but didn't know anything about it. So I'm like, I want to go see this movie just because I appreciate the ambition of like what he's trying to do. Oh, and I think he self-financed this to the tune of like $100 million of his own money or something. So like, this is like this big epic movie. So I'm like, let's go see this. So I asked my mom, because I told my mom I would take her to the movies for her birthday, and she's like, let's go see Megalopolis.
You took your mom.
Yeah, so I took my mom and my 15-year-old son, knowing nothing about it, just that it's Francis Ford Coppola, and it's like the craziest, like, and there are some pretty gnarly, inappropriate scenes, and I'm like sitting right next to my 15-year-old. It was great.
Your 15-year-old son and your mom.
And my mother, yeah. It was a good experience.
The great performances of WoW Platinum.
Yeah.
And Claudio and Cicero.
Yeah. I had to look up who all the characters. What's Shia LaBeouf? Yeah, Claudio.
Yeah.
Were you guys going to watch this movie before I said something about it? Was it on your radar?
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For me, yeah.
Definitely not for me. I wasn't even aware of it until you guys started talking about it.
Yeah. I mean, this has had a famous kind of like always in the background, you know, talk of Francis Ford Coppola's like troubled development with this for several years, and just the fact that it's actually coming out is, you know, was kind of insane. Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of infamous, you know, if you're at all familiar with like Francis Ford Coppola, he went through a very like big break after having kind of many failures after his like epic run of like movies from the 70s and 80s. It was like,
when you say he had a break, like he took a vacation, or you mean he had like a mental break?
No, he took a break. He talks he about like
his, yeah, yeah, okay.
He took a break to learn, and he went into huge debt with one movie even before this called One from the Heart, I think. And then but before that, he had the epic run of Godfather 1, Godfather 2, and then Apocalypse Now, and then The Conversation.
Don't forget Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, I don't even know about that one. Was that in there in between those?
Peggy Sue Got Married was in 86, so it was between Godfather 2 and 3.
Oh, well, yeah, the third Godfather like was in the 90s or something.
Yeah,
like
was
that.
Way later.
It
was weird. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's got a kind of a crazy film career, and you kind of think, well, he made what a lot of people consider like the best movies of all time, The Godfather, which I actually just watched for the first time recently because...
Oh, really?
Really?
Yeah, it's my dad's favorite movie. He talks about it all the time, and with this, you know, watching this movie, I had to at least watch, you know, one of his great movies to compare.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen The Godfather?
Oh, yeah. I think everyone has seen The Godfather.
It's 3 hours. Like, it's
great.
Exactly, yeah. 3 hours. It's great. It is. And it, you know, it has like a story through line that you can actually comprehend.
I read the book, like, you know, a couple years ago that it's based on.
Okay.
Not, you know, just knowing that the movie was great. And the book is absolutely amazing, too. That was my favorite book I read that year. In fact, I bought a copy of that book for my dad and my brother for Christmas, saying, this book is so good. If you've seen the movie, you should read the book because it's great, too.
Is that even, like, based on a true story? Or
No, I don't think so. The whole thing is fiction. And he talks a lot about how, actually, I forget who writes the book. What's his name? If you told me, I'd know what it was. But he talks about developing the characters, and he went through a lot of the same stuff that the writers of The Sopranos did. Was he wrote this book and it became popular, and then all these like legitimate mobsters started approaching him and, you know, trying to get him to do more, and trying to, it became bigger than itself. You know, that he was like, I was just writing a fiction book, and all these real mobsters are like, oh, we would never do that. We would do it this way. And he started getting pressure to do all these different things. Mario Puzo, that's the guy. Yeah, the book has a crazy history, too.
I mean, it's based on, you know, that era of organized crime, which is which is a real era. But yeah, there isn't a Corleone, an actual Corleone family, but sure. Yeah, it's a great movie. I did like it. Lots of killing, lots of power moving.
For sure. I don't disagree, but I think we got together to talk about Megalopolis.
Well, when you said killing, a lot of killing, and what did you say, power moving? I mean, you could be describing Megalopolis, right?
Yeah. Actually, I did kind of find some similarities in sort of its sprawling nature and like, yeah, you know, the power dynamics. But anyway, yeah, so we're here to talk about this movie, Megalopolis.
Can we talk about one thing? Because we talked about this at lunch, and I want Doug to explain this to me, because the very opening scene, like, I mean, we're 5 seconds into the movie. You have Adam Driver climbing out on the top of that skyscraper, and he walks over to the edge, and he looks like he's going to walk off, and he stops time, and he doesn't fall off, and then he goes back in the window. I've seen the movie twice now, and I still don't understand that scene. And I don't care. I've come to the realization that Megalopolis, it's not a story. Like, it's a piece of art. You just look at it and you're like, this is crazy. This is insane. Like, the scope of this movie. Like, I don't feel like I have to understand all of it, but I'm just intrigued because Doug said he did understand that beginning scene. And I'm curious if you can explain it to me.
Yes, I don't mind doing that. I can only offer my interpretation.
I have no interpretation. I just think it's crazy. So I want to hear what you have to say.
So the way that I interpret that is, and they discuss it a little bit later in the movie, but the creatives, the visionaries, the artists, the architects, the musicians, they have a way of seeing the world and experiencing the world differently. And that's where the basis of his power to stop time. He is able to kind of stop the world around him to interpret it and look at it as he sees fit. And that scene there at the beginning is him kind of testing and proving to himself, like, am I really a creative type of person who has this ability to use this perspective? And he proves it to himself. And that's why, you know, initially he kind of goes up there hesitantly, but then he stops it and he's successful in preventing his own death. And then he kind of flexes the power a little bit, as we see later in the movie.
But I mean, the whole point I would say of this, I mean, the entirety of this movie is grounded in reality other than his ability to stop time, which only comes up like once or twice in the movie. It felt out of place. Like, the literal movie starts with him exhibiting this superpower. So you're almost led to believe like this is going to be some sort of science fiction movie. And then 95% of it is just these two titans of industry fighting with each other. It's not about, it was just a weird way to start the movie. And I don't know.
I would point out it is brought up more than just a couple of times. It's actually one of the main driving plot points, why he even accepts, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but why he even accepts, I can't remember her character's name, Natalie Emmanuel, why he accepts her as an equal to share his vision, is because she proves that she has that perspective as well.
Okay, so you're
that's not how I interpret it.
You've already taken more away from it. I see what you're saying. No, that's, I'm understanding that, but I did not take that away from the movie. I'm not going to lie, I didn't understand a lot of this movie, and I don't again, I don't know if that's bad. I thoroughly enjoyed this movie because it's so crazy and over the top. But it doesn't feel like it has a story with a beginning and a middle and an end, and the characters all progress. Like, it's all over the board. It almost feels like, you know, there's, you know, scenes on the cutting room floor where, you know, character A gets to, you know, set piece B, and then, but we never see that because it got cut for time kind of thing.
So, okay.
It doesn't, to me, and again, I've seen it twice, and I was worried the second time, maybe I'm going to understand this now that I've seen the whole thing. Like, is it going to be more coherent now that I understand where these characters start and where they end? And even the second time, it still felt disjointed.
Fair I mean, enough. I understood what you're saying, Doug, and that is, I mean, that's partly how I took the whole time stop thing. Is that it's like a creative, artistic, like an analogy for the artistic power of being creative and having a creative outlook, I guess. You know, that's what I think he's described himself as having, as like an ability to stop time in you know, making movies. You can kind of manipulate time as you're making the movie. I don't know, something along those lines. I don't think it's very concrete. But
I would literally say it's an example of thinking outside the box. Everyone is trapped in the box of time and the flow of time, and he's able to think outside of it.
Sure. If you look at it from like an artistic point of view, like you see some amazing art hanging in a museum, or the architecture on this building is amazing, and it literally stops you in your tracks and you lose track of time. That I could see, like that's bounded in reality. Like I can see that there's a, oh, you know, this seeing this art is a transcendental experience. It takes me out of my, you know, being standing in this museum, looking at this painting, and it makes me think these things beyond. This is like a visual representation of that. Seeing these crazy artistic things in this world literally allow them to stop time.
Sure. I mean, that's a fair,
I don't want to get hung assessment. Up on the time stopping thing. Cause that's such a small part of this movie, and it's not a part that I really care about. It's just funny that the movie starts with that, and it's not,
you say,
really,
Doug, you say it's that it's a big part. You say it's a big part, but like, when does it actually come into play in any meaningful way in the whole movie?
At the very beginning, when we learn that he has the ability to do it, at the part where he tears down the building and she's able to see that he's stopping time, thus proving that she's equal of his. Later, when they connect romantically, he's able to stop time. At the end, when he loses the ability to stop time, and then at the very finale, when he stops time, but we see that it's no longer him and her that are experiencing outside the box of time, but it's now the baby, indicating that the creativity belongs to the future.
Yes, but I would argue that none of those qualify as meaningful uses of this ability.
They're only demonstrations.
Maybe the end. Maybe the end part. I guess you could say that's like a meaningful, you know, use, I guess, but that's not even his use. It seems to be more passively
so
passed what is, on.
What is your interpretation of the time stops? I'm curious how you think it fits in.
No, I think your assessment is right. My main criticism is that it's not used effectively in the movie. It's only a measure of his like confidence, I guess. Like his confidence as an artistic person. Like he gets framed for statutory rape, and then he's acquitted, but he still loses that ability, and he needs to regain it. He regains it by obtaining the love of a woman, and like having a muse, and that's how I took it. It's not that she's his equal, but that she's his muse, and I really dislike, you know, number one, like how the movie treats women. In every woman is like a vicious villain manipulating, you know, evil person, or like a, you know, an angel muse that will like, you know, will, you know, investigate your statutory rape accusations for you. Like, that's, I guess it's a sort of a different criticism than what you're saying, but like, That's the main problem, is that the time stop thing specifically, he doesn't actually use it in any meaningful way in the plot.
So if I could pose a question without trying to completely take over the conversation, backing up a bit, what were your guys' overall thoughts? Baker, you kind of alluded already that you just sort of looked at it as an artistic piece. And I sat back and enjoyed the art.
Yeah, I enjoyed it this is a wild, huge set piece with amazing actors. And the story they were trying to tell really swung for the fences, these huge titans of industry fighting, and then they come together and it's a love story. And there, I appreciate it for the majesty that it tried to get to. Did it get there? I don't think so, because I didn't feel like it was a coherent story. But from an artistic point of view, I really liked it. I think I said at lunch when we were talking, I went back and watched Brazil after watching this, because I see a lot of similarities in that, where just so many scenes in this movie are absurd just to be absurd. It doesn't necessarily advance the plot. It's, you know, to quote Mo from The Simpsons, you know, it's weird for the sake of weird. So there were that's what I liked. I looked at it and I was just like, this is just a crazy piece of art that this famous director got away with because he is who he is and he self-financed this. So from that point of view, I liked it. From a storytelling point of view, I thought it kind of sucked. I mean, half of what you're explaining to me now, like, you understood it better watching it once than I understood better watching it twice. And that's fine. I don't care. I liked it for different reasons.
Well, I mean, I will just clarify there. I don't think there's a better, everybody gets to interpret it however they want.
Right.
If what you get out of watching it is appreciating an artistic vision, fantastic. Anyway, Jason, what were your thoughts?
I actually mostly agree with what you just said. Like, I do fully appreciate what this movie is. It's such a unique piece of art that, you know, isn't going to happen ever again, anything like this. It's fully self-financed. It's big budget. Lots of millions of dollars were put into it, but there was no studio oversight, which, you know, could be considered, like, could have ended up in a bad, you know, could have steered this into a more more palatable product. But I agree that on its own, it's a stark view into the filmmaker's vision, and you can starkly see what he's going for. And, you know, and almost, to me, it's almost too much hitting you over the head with, like, the politics and, like, you know, his messages and, like, all, you know, he's stating things. There's a narrator that, like, literally every few moments in the movie, he reiterates the themes of the movie. And so I appreciate it for that aspect. And there is plenty of artistic, you know, or there's plenty of beautiful scenery and performances that are amazing, like especially Aubrey Plaza, which we experienced in the intro.
Yeah, I think Aubrey Plaza and Shia LaBeouf just, like, really, they were phenomenal in this movie. One thing I want to say, just so that we get it out there.
Well, can I finish?
All right, go ahead. Sorry.
Let me finish my full, because that's my first, you know, part of my reaction. The second part is, fuck this movie. This movie is terrible. Like, it's actually just a bad movie on many levels, including I find the themes kind of disgusting. Like, I find that the ideas that we can get into later about, you know, what this movie's prescriptions are, and just the way that, like, yeah, like I said earlier, the way that the women characters are pretty bad, and the story beats, there's so many things that come, plot elements that kind of, like, come out of nowhere. They're literally out of nowhere. There was zero lead up to these big these supposed payoffs. There are weird scenes where, you know, like, Dustin Hoffman specifically is the one that I am the most confused by. Can I please play a clip?
Yeah.
Go for it.
This whole dialogue from Dustin Hoffman, he's sort of like the fixer, although he's also like the union guy that gives him his power, but
he had a small part for such a big actor.
He had like three scenes. Yeah, this was his like main scene, and it just baffles me here.
He faked that video of Catalina somehow. He's picking up a large popular constituency. He's some kind of genius. He can talk everything.
You handle this, Nash.
Okay, I'll fix it. Just wanted to check with you first. Because, you know, Julia? I don't mind the lightning, but the thunder scares the shit out of me.
That was not cut up. I didn't cut any of that up. It just, that's the literal scene. And it just feels like it was like cut up from various of his performances. I'm pretty sure he shot like very few scenes, and they kind of patched like audio and scenes together for
that
Dustin
whole character
Hoffman.
Felt really underused. And then when he dies, you're like, eh. Mm-hmm. Because like he was only, he had such a small part, but they tried to build up his death to be a big thing. I can't.
His death happens in a like basically time lapse type of montage, throwaway one line, and then some time passed, and oh yeah, so and so's dead.
Right.
Yeah, here it is. Here. I love it. Here.
That old fool Nash tried to muscle you out of politics.
Yeah, that was the scene after the next one. It was pretty absurd. So like the execution is bad. I think there are so many elements of the movie that are just out of whack and obviously indulgent, and like he's having fun, I think. But you know, to me it's just not a good movie. And so sorry, that's all to finish up my opinion of the movie. So
like, I think you have a really good point, and I want to let Doug talk real quick. But when you said the word indulgent, I feel like the entire movie, like all 2 hours and 18 minutes of it, are just indulgent. Like that's the point to me. Like that's what I took away from it.
Yeah.
Is like how deep can I get into this thing that doesn't really matter? How
can I make this basically only mean anything to me as the filmmaker and not really mean it much? I mean, it means stuff, but like it to me, what it means is so pat and so like just sort of
how far
non-enlightening.
Can I get up my own ass,
it's not enlightening in any way for me. So yeah, it fails on a number of levels. But I love it, and I'm glad it exists. So yeah,
anyway. I agree. I want to hear Doug's opinion.
So this is kind of unoriginal, and I'm sorry to say, but I agree with absolutely everything you guys have said.
Wow!
Like one, there are moments in this film where it is just almost breathtaking how big and epic it is, and just how visually stunning. Like wow!
Wow, indeed.
Yep, indeed. Do you have like a soundboard or something? Like,
I do. Yeah, I had to have some of these clips, man. Like we have to show the sort of the viral one that went viral.
We will.
Okay. Yeah, but keep going.
Finish, Doug.
Big and epic at times. Absolute mess at times, just incoherent. What the hell is going on? Absurdity. There were some brilliant performances. Like I gotta hand it to some of the actors. They really committed to the roles that they were playing. And there were also some characters that, regardless of how brilliantly they were acted, were just kind of like, this is stupid. Like,
yeah.
So every good thing there was about the film, there was equal amounts of what the hell. And I would 100% agree with the word indulgent. This movie is a case study in what happens when there are no checks, no balances, no oversight. This is just runaway creative vision, and it's a mess. It is all over the place.
Sometimes that works, though. Like, you know, when who made Fury Road? I want to say George
Romero.
Romero. Didn't they basically give him a check for $100 million and say, go out in the desert and film this movie and bring us back whatever you come up with? Like, there was very little oversight on that, and it fucking worked. It was amazing, right?
Yeah.
I feel like if you're, you know, whatever studio put this out and Francis Ford Coppola with his resume comes to you and says, this is the movie I want to make, you're not going to say no. I mean, that's like James Cameron walking in going, I want to make Titanic 2, you know, where Jack survives. You're going to be like, what? But okay, you're, you know, you don't say no to some of these people. I feel like that's part of
get one of those chances. And I think, right. You know, if you know Coppola's history, he's had multiple failures after that initial run of movies. Like One from the Heart is famous for that. It was supposed to be sort of a like by the numbers, like romantic comedy musical at the time. They were really popular. So it was supposed to be a moneymaker. It was supposed to be his sort of like way of getting out of some debts that he had. He took it to the next level. He wanted to get ownership of it. He created his own studio, Zoetrope Studios, and he wanted to make it into live cinema. So he wanted to record the whole thing live. That didn't work out, but it just ended up being a huge failure. So I think you could interpret his talents, his ability as a filmmaker in a couple different ways. I think you could say he kind of mastered it in his early career, and then he's just trying to look to do something new. He's kind of bored with just mastering and making the best films of all time. But you could also say like he's just sort of declined. His talents have kind of, you know, gone away as he's gotten older. But
I want to talk about that a little bit, because Francis Ford Coppola is 85 today. So he was 82 when he started making this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to crap on old people, but 82 is a lot. That's pretty up there to be doing something this big. He was clearly swinging for the fences. This most likely is going to be his last movie. If you look at his filmography, he hasn't made a whole lot of movies lately, and I'm guessing he's not going to get a whole lot of opportunities after this. If I look at Wikipedia right now, the budget for this movie was about $130 million, and as of right now, it's made 13. So, I mean, you're not going to be seeing the Megalopolis 2. Like, it's not happening, right?
Oh, God. I would actually pay, though, to go
I
see
would. Megalopolis 2. I would love to see that. The only other thing I wrote down in my notes is we were talking about the women characters all being terrible in this. It's worth noting that in the 2 hours and 18 minutes that is Megalopolis, this movie does not pass the Bechdel test, which is a pretty low bar.
I didn't even think of that, but that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. So, I mean, Doug, did you kind of complete your thoughts overall on the movie? Did you have any other overall thoughts?
Not really overall thought, but I will just add one small comment. After watching this, my wife and I, we watched it together. My wife and I turned to each other and we kind of agreed that, like, that was a lot to try and process through as we were watching it. It was not easy to watch. Like,
right.
Every scene, you're trying to think, you're trying to figure out, you're trying to follow it, you're trying to understand, what is this scene's purpose? What is the message of this? Also, just what the hell is going on in the movie?
Was your 15-year-old son sitting next to you?
No.
During this? That takes away from it, too, during all the weird sex scenes.
I was your mom.
I don't fortunate. Recommend
it. That sounds awful, man.
It was pretty crazy.
I have that clip if we want to... You know, we need to analyze it and decode it, you know.
Hit me, yeah.
It is very non-safe for work, so maybe I'll bleep stuff, but here we go.
Kiss it. Grandpa Crassus is beginning to doubt that you're giving up on politics. You are a very bad, bad boy. But you're lucky, because Auntie Wow has come here to help you. Are you lucky?
Yes.
Yes, what?
Yes, Auntie. Wow.
What's that?
That's your pussy.
I said, what is that?
That's Caesar's Megalopolis using up the city's power.
You think it's all over the city?
It's all over the city.
You want to fuck me?
I want to fuck you so bad, Auntie. Wow.
It doesn't, you know, you really need the visual element, but...
You do, of Shia LaBeouf, like, ramming his face in her panties.
Yeah, they really committed.
Props to Aubrey Plaza for really leaning into that scene, because that had to be pretty wild and uncomfortable. I'm curious how close the intimacy coordinator was on that, because like that was pretty risque.
Yeah. So, I mean, we could try to break down the story and like kind of explain it, at least from what, you know, the way we saw it, or we could just try to go plot point through the plot points, you know, quickly.
If we want, I mean, again, what I took away from it, the plot was really secondary to it. I mean, it was, you got, I even forget the characters' names. You got Cicero versus Caesar. You have these two gigantic titans of industry, right? You know, I was trying to explain it to my 15-year-old. You got your Elon Musk's versus your Mark Zuckerberg's, and they both want to be the biggest swinging dick around, and they want to put their mark on history, right? So that's what these two people are trying to do. They're clearly at odds with each other. Halfway through the movie, they realize that they need each other. You know, then he ends up dating what's-his-name's daughter, and then they have a kid, and then he gets shot in the face, and you see some boobies in there. So, I mean, that was what I took away.
Yeah, there we go. Mm-hmm.
Because I did not enjoy the plot, I would be more interested in talking about the parts that I did like, the artistry and the indulgency and the over-the-top characters. If we want to talk about, like, I mean, I absolutely adored Aubrey Plaza's character in this. I like Aubrey Plaza in kind of everything she does, but she really took it to 11 in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, what the hell? Her character's name is literally Wow. And it's never explained. It's just a thing. Like, my name is Wow. Like, what the hell? Like, that's so, it's just so weird and so indulgent, right? And she's just what this, I guess, like a tabloid reporter. I mean, she's a reporter of some kind, and she, you know, basically tries to sleep her way to the top. She's trying to sleep with everybody. I thought her performance and the way she leaned into it, you know, like she really took it to 11, right? And Shia LaBeouf too, like both being just despicable characters, but like they were my favorite parts of the movie because they were so wild.
Yeah, and Francis, I've listened to a couple of interviews of his about this, because I was so curious of, like, is he taking this seriously, or is he have his tongue in his cheek a little bit? And he does admit, like, how ridiculous, like, a lot of the scenes and stuff are in the movie. He noted that, and he's aware. I think he's fully aware of, like, just how crazy things are. He one story he told about the sort of like hallucinogenic drug trip scene. Do you remember that? Caesar's kind of backstage at this like celebration.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It was like his father and Wow, like a marriage ceremony, I think. And then there was that supposed virgin, at a suite or something, and people were bidding on her, and that's a whole other thing. That's crazy.
Let's not just dance past that. Can someone please explain to me what the hell that was about? There was a lot that I understood in the film, or at least I was able to interpret in my own way, but that one just left me kind of like, what the fuck did I just watch?
Were they bidding on like taking her virginity?
I wasn't quite sure.
But she's 16. Supposedly she was 16, I think.
Definitely added to the what the hell factor for me.
I thought they were like donating to a charity.
It was like to her purity or something, or some sort of purity.
I don't know.
Thing. But like
it was super weird, is what it was.
Why were they running it like an auction then?
Yeah, I don't know. She was basically like having this little Taylor Swift moment in the middle of this arena, and she comes down, you know, and she's singing and like, what the hell?
And she's wearing Megalon like outfit.
Oh, that's right. She has that, like, weird. Yeah.
It's supposed to be like this magical element, and they just used a green screen dress. Right. But that was wild. I think it's supposed to represent like the excess of a wealthy, you know, nation on the verge of collapse, you know, that type of thing. I don't know this, like, what specifically was going on with that. But there's a whole scene.
Really, like, that was one of the more indulgent scenes in the movie, because there were so many characters. Everybody's watching from the sidelines, right? And like you said, I mean, it didn't make sense. The set pieces were huge. It was just like just so over the top. And then, yeah, I mean, they literally in the middle of this thing, they cut to like a sex tape of this 16-year-old. It's just
okay.
Weird.
We'll get to that. But the story I was wanting to tell is, you know, the backstage
Yeah, sorry.
Part of it is when Caesar is being sort of chased by Julia backstage, and it looks like they have a rope. You know, do you remember that? They're kind of like, it looks like there's a rope tied around Caesar, and she's like kind of pulling on it, and they're sort of doing this miming of a tether type thing.
Yeah.
Apparently that is an acting exercise to like get warmed up or whatever, and they filmed that to just start out with, and then they filmed it normally later. But then in the edit, he's like, "Well, that's pretty cool. We'll just go with that." Same thing with the intro scene where he's doing Shakespeare. They're kind of gathered, Cicero and Clodagh, everyone sort of gathered at this like site for a proposal to build something. Cicero wants to build a casino. Caesar, you know, comes out with just this speech, and he just does Shakespeare. He does the to be or not to be, you know?
Yeah, like in the most indulgent way. Like,
it makes no sense because he's supposed to be like this brash, like artistic guy, but this speech is about killing yourself. Anyway, that was also like an exercise just to get him warmed up. That was just meant at, you know, they were just playing around when they were doing that, basically. And then they ended up saying, oh, we'll just put that in. That seems pretty cool.
Well, it starts off because it's Giancarlo, what's his name? It's Cicero, like, and he's making a legit, you know, this proposal. Like, I want to build this casino or what, I forget exactly what he wanted to do. And then you got Caesar Catalina, and he just launches, like you said, he just launches into Shakespeare. He's like, he's not taking anything seriously. This whole thing is just absurd, right?
It's absurd. And I guess maybe that's the point. I don't know. Doug, sorry.
No, I would just offer, I found that scene a bit jarring, disjointed, like a little hard to take the Caesar character seriously, because he just comes in and he's like, I'm going to do Shakespeare in the park. And I will say that was probably the first, but not the only time in the film where I wanted to watch Giancarlo Esposito pull out a box cutter and just start cutting motherfuckers' throats.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I mean, that it's such a weird scene, and that's your introduction to the Caesar character. We're 10 minutes in, and that's the first time you see him, and he's doing Shakespeare in front of all the, not paparazzi, but in front of all the press who are there to cover this real proposal. You're just like, who is this guy? Like, why does anybody take him seriously?
It's almost infuriating, like you were saying. It's infuriating, because that whole speech thing is so overdone. Like, and you're coming out with this, you know, to be or not to be.
But it's
slings and arrows, and like, we've heard it a million times, and it's supposed to be some sort of impressive entrance. I don't know.
Is that any different, though?
Like,
is that any different than Elon Musk going and hanging out with Trump and being at a rally and talking about whatever strange shit he's talking about? Is that any different than Zuckerberg going on his Facebook video feed and talking about, you know, VR or whatever? Like, I just kind of took that as these guys are so rich and so powerful that the rules don't apply to them anymore. So they just decide, hey, I'm just going to be weird because it's weird for the sake of weird. Yeah, I'm so rich and powerful, no one's going to tell me no.
Do you think that's what Coppola was trying to communicate, as far as like Caesar being so arrogant and like boastful and sort of like an Elon Musk analog?
Well, I think that Caesar was detached from reality. Right. I think he, yeah. So, I mean, is Elon Musk detached from reality? Yeah, I think so. But I think you've got your Cicero, who's more grounded. And I think that's sort of like their battle, right? Is, you know, the one guy's trying to build Megalopolis out of this made up metal. And the other guy's like, come on, man, we got real problems to solve. Can't we just build a casino?
I guess my specific question is, do you think that Francis is trying to portray Caesar the sort of Elon Musk analog, which I think obviously he is, but like, do you think he's trying to portray him as the hero? Like, cause he kind of seems like the good guy throughout the movie. Or do you, like you said, is he trying to portray him as this, you know, arrogant, narcissistic, you know, rich dude that's just, you know, you know, doing whatever he wants. What is he trying to portray?
I think he does a really good job of leaving it ambiguous and leaving it up to the viewer to decide whether or not he's a hero or whether or not he's Looney Tunes, right? There's a lot of people that look at Elon Musk and think he's a complete visionary, and then there's other people that look at him and are like, this guy is fucking nuts, right? I mean, he's talking about whatever, space lasers and whatever crap he's talking about. Mm-hmm. So there's this huge dichotomy of people that, you know, of people of that stature, some people look up to them and some people think they're crazy. So, I may be jaded because we just had an election and it was very nuts, so...
Yeah, Doug, do you think that he's portraying him as like a heroic figure? Like, you're supposed to, especially in that scene, what do you think Francis is trying to tell us about this?
So, I would first of all say I don't see him as an Elon analog one to one. I mean, obviously, there's similarities of, and I'm using the biggest air quotes I can here, but visionary type people. But I think overall he is good.
The ending is good. He's
portrayed as sympathetic, you know, seeing when you finally see the truth of what happened with his wife and the sorrow and loneliness he deals with. That's a sympathetic character. He shows us this visionary utopia future that he's trying to design. All of that is very positive. There are moments of arrogance, but I think that's less to try and turn him into a evil or a contemptuous character. It's more about showing us that he's flawed. Perfect characters suck. They're not that entertaining. So showing some sort of flaws in his character sort of grounds him and in a weird way makes him even more likable.
I think that's good. Let me play a clip that kind of demonstrates kind of exactly what we're talking about with this character.
And you think 1 year of medical school entitles you to plow through the riches of my Emersonian mind?
Entitles me?
Yes.
Entitles me?
Yes.
Entitles me?
Yes.
You have no idea about me. You think I am nothing, just a socialite?
No, not nothing, but I reserve my time for people who can think about science and literature and architecture and art. You find me cruel, selfish, and unfeeling? I am. I work without caring what happens to either of us. So go back to the club, bear it all, and stalk the kind of people that you enjoy.
Fine.
That's amazing. That was the viral clip that definitely made the rounds. But infuriating. You know?
I think he did a really good job of showing Caesar's flaws. And clearly he's a very flawed character. I mean, he probably has more flaws than he has redeeming characteristics.
I don't know. I don't think he has flaws. I think he's flawless in the movie, actually. He's exonerated from every bad thing he does. He's vindicated for all of his opinions and his like visions. He you know, the only failures that he has are put upon him where someone's trying to frame him, or you know, his wife has an accident. He is presented as a perfect, you know, character, I think. And
but he doesn't disgusting. Have any like good or healthy relationships with anyone in the movie, really.
Isn't that the curse of being the troubled genius,
right?
That you're so much above everybody else that you can't relate to them and it's so lonely.
That's where I keep getting this like Elon Musk analog. Like the guy, no one likes the guy. He's got how many different wives? And anyway,
I think he said
that's this troubled genius.
I do want to point out one thing though, in relation to that specific scene that you just did the clip from. What happens immediately after that? What's the next thing that happens? She talks about, hey, by the way, I saw you stop time when you were like destroying that building. And then he's like, hold on, you saw me stop time? now you're interesting. Let me go show you my, it's mm-hmm. basically a setup of a bunch of junk, but
yeah.
it's a test. Can she see the visionary? And she does. And then he accepts her and starts bringing her along and showing her stuff. So yeah. I'm just tying this back to what I was talking about earlier, where I was pointing out that once he sees that, oh, she's a creative visionary as well, then he accepts her as a peer. It is kind of a significant point in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you make of that, though, exactly? Like, I guess it's so it says that she's artistic and that's good enough for him, or what?
It's both a significant point and extremely indulgent, right? I mean, that's another example of just the over the top, like just the verbiage, the you know, the verbal diarrhea that comes out of this guy's mouth. You're like, what the fuck is this, man?
Yeah. But
yeah, it works in a weird way that this guy, right? He's a non-neurotypical, you know, genius. Well, I hesitate to use that word.
I think we're getting into my main issue with the movie, and it goes beyond indulgent. And I think Caesar is actually more of a Francis analog. Like for him, as he's had so much trouble, you know, getting projects funded, and he's the true genius. If only everyone would just listen to him,
right?
And he's espousing this idea of utopia, like, oh, we just need to talk and have a conversation, but really you just need to listen to me and do everything I say, and I need to destroy, you know, these people's houses, and the rabble are dumb, manipulated, you know, fools that will fall for a populist, in this Trump analog in Claudio, where he is quite literally saying exact things that Trump has said, like this.
Yeah.
Or this
one. We are powerful, and we are taking our country back.
And so it's and he's fighting against the government, right? Cicero, he's the bureaucrat, and he has to kind of like go by the rules and do things in reality. And it's like, yeah, you do. You have to go through, a consensus of opinion, and you espouse this idea of conversation and asking questions and talking, but it's nowhere is it demonstrated that that is what happens. He, at the end, he's speaking on this loudspeaker to the riot of people, protesting, and he's just telling them how it's going to be. And basically he gets his way, and there's a utopia, and yay for Elon Musk / Francis.
I guess. Yeah.
No, I definitely agree with, there were times in the film where I picked up the, oh my God, like, get over yourself. It was very clearly him talking about his troubled genius ideas.
Yeah.
Like, good God, man. Like,
well, it gets,
this is why you need the studio oversight.
It gets to the kind of like a political aspect of it that really irks me, is like this libertarian versus, bureaucrat or like democracy. It's almost anti-democratic. It's anti-union because the union guys are the bad guys, Mm-hmm. So it's this idea that if you're just one of the smart people, then you should be listened to, you should be, individually celebrated, and you shouldn't have to listen to anyone, that you perceive. You automatically frame like this hierarchy of people. There's automatically this lower class of people that should not be listened to. There's automatically these smart people, that are always like, having trouble getting their way, and so on and so forth. It's very
not to make this whole thing about Elon Musk, but isn't that legitimately a thing that he said, something to the effect of, whatever, the smart people should be given more power in government. The smart people should get 2 votes and the dumb people should get 1, kind of thing. Like, that's the kind of stuff he talks about all the time. Like, that's his, again, the troubled genius, like, nobody gets me. I'm smarter than everybody. I should have this control, and everybody else should just trust me. Right. I mean, that's what a lot of this is about. I mean, that's what Caesar's doing. Like, I've got this magic metal. You guys just don't understand. Just get out of my way and let me build you this cool city. Right.
Yeah. Right. But it's also about a conversation. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Sure.
Did either of you at times pick up some Atlas Shrugged type vibes?
For sure.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he actually wanted to make that movie at one point. So yeah, he does align with that. But yeah, that stuff really is, I find, reprehensible. So that's, it goes beyond just like not understanding the movie. Like the themes really I found gross. So it's like such this weird, it's just it's an amazing movie, you know?
It was. I agree with you. I'm glad it exists. Do I understand it? No. Was it coherent? No. But it definitely had some amazing parts. So
I think it's too coherent. I think it's too on the nose, personally. Like the incoherence is in the execution in certain like things. Like there's the satellite that crashes, you know, the big disaster.
No, what part?
What's that about? It's
right in the middle, there's a huge, it comes out of nowhere. There's literally no build up to it. Suddenly, Cicero's assistant, Jason Schwartzman, he comes in and says, "You're not going to believe this, Mayor." And it's this giant satellite, I guess, that's crashing into the city. It's like about one hour, 20 minutes in. And there's some kind of cool imagery of like people shadow boxing on skyscrapers, like it's some sort of like 9/11 thing. You guys don't even remember?
I don't remember. I'm watching it right now, and I don't even remember this part.
120, 122.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's 120.
And then right after, there's that scene of that like interactive scene. But yeah, anyway, that, yeah, you don't even remember it, but that's big pivotal part in the movie, I supposedly, where the city needs to be rebuilt, and so who's going to do it and all that.
Is that all what happens, really? So hang on a second. Yeah. I did not pick that up at all. So the satellite crashes in and messes up part of the city. So he's like, hang on, I'm going to solve the problem with my megalonium or whatever and rebuild it.
Yep, that's what
happens. Makes total sense when you explain it, but I did not pick that up watching it.
No, 100%. Yeah. I missed that as well. So thank you. That because clarifies.
It's literally on the screen for 4 seconds. I don't remember this at all. That's so fucking weird.
There's zero. You'd think they'd like have some sort of build up or like scene early on. It was like, oh man, those Russian satellites, they've been, you know, barely missing ours or whatever. And
oh, you're right. Yeah. And they're doing the weird shadow dancing on the buildings as the things come down. I didn't realize that's what this was.
Yeah. But no, it's out of nowhere. Jason Schwartzman just comes into Cicero's office and says, "You're not going to believe this, sir."
And but it's on screen for 4 seconds. They show like a little bit of smoke.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to Caesar and he's designing his city. There's no. God, that's such a weird way to tell the story.
The creative. Okay. There's so much, but the scene right after that, which is like cuts to Caesar, like in this press conference, like answering questions, I guess. But like apparently in the first screen, I think it was at Sundance, they had Jason Schwartzman physically go into the theater and step up to a microphone. Did you hear about that?
I heard that they wanted to do part of this movie live in certain theaters.
Yeah. Yeah, and they did that for that first screening. They just had him ask a question and to his head. But then in like in a regular theater that I was at, they just had the voiceover kind of, you know, flashed onto the back of this guy's head, which it looks like he's talking the whole time too. I don't know. Anyway, it's such terrible to execution. He's like not concerned with like communicating basic plot points like that or communicating what's happening. So yeah, you're right. It's very incoherent as far as like the plot points and stuff.
And so what was, I mean, I guess it's just Hollywood movie making, but you know, the big, I don't know, reveal is the wrong word, where Caesar gets shot in the head by that kid. That caught me. That scared the crap out of me. But like, I was not expecting that at all. Like, oh, here's this kid. And then it's just literally crazy. Just this loud bang. Like, I jumped. I was like, whoa, that did not go where I was expecting it. And then he gets shot in the head. And then fast forward like two or three scenes later, and he's got megalonium on his head and no eyeball. But somehow he survives. Like, what the hell, man?
Like, yeah, okay. Here's that little sort of like montage of Megalon. Megalon's abilities.
Megalon has no delineation, knows no boundaries. Megalon will activate some of the signals that will express genes.
Subatomic particles, atoms, molecules, human connection.
Megalon fuses all forces.
Will activate some of the signals that will express genes.
We'll use Sunny Hope's DNA.
Enabling Caesar to grow his face.
Like a second skin.
From receptors. Do you have the cells?
It is a language.
So... It's a bunch of gobbledygook.
Yeah, right. It's just, I mean, that's the, I mean, that's what, I don't know. Is that a Deus Ex Machina? I mean, that's a, just a, just a fantastic solution to an impossible problem, right? Oh, okay. We'll just get this magic pixie dust and he's good again. Like, how convenient, right?
Yeah, but you're the director and writer and producer. Why even bother shooting him in the first place if you're just going to Deus Ex Machina him back?
That's, I mean, because it gives him something to, you know, rebel against. It gives him, it gives him some character.
Great point, Doug. Actually, like, literally why? It's like literally next scene, and I don't think there's any like anything is affected after that by his accident. Like, he just shows his face.
You suppose this is a sort of metaphor for how society tries to tear down and destroy the geniuses that try and lead us to a utopia? Is it something as ham-fisted as that?
It could be.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, just, it's just a matter of, like, Claudio, the jealous populist, trying to kill him.
It's just an analog for all the movies Francis Ford Coppola wasn't allowed to make by a big studio.
Yeah, it was more of specifically his the populace not appreciating him enough and, like, wounding him putting him in major debt, because he, like, went in huge amounts of debt and had to, like, he was, like, forced to make, like, 10 corporate movies or something. So I'm sure he's not bitter about all of that.
If that's the case, why would he go $100 million in debt for this movie?
I think he's fine. He really only sold part of one of his wine companies, so he's, like, actually, he's going to be fine.
I'm not worried about his finances, $1 million or $100 million is a lot to.
You get old enough and you're just like, fuck it. I mean, that's what this movie is.
I think you're right. I think this is a 82, 83, 84 year old guy, and he's just like, fuck it, I don't care what you think. I'm gonna take my Megalopolis and go home. Like,
it goes back to what you were talking about at the very beginning. Like, this is a one of a kind film. You will never see this type of film again. You will never see just a complete no breaks, no checks. 100%. This is my artistic vision. Once in a lifetime, man. This isn't going to happen again.
I don't know if I agree with that, though, because I really feel like Fury Road, that was the same kind of deal, right? I mean,
that was a pretty studio movie. I think he had help, like, with editing, like, didn't he? No. I don't know.
I don't know the details.
Even Fury Road, I feel like, was made for an audience. I don't feel like this was made for, it was made for an audience of Francis Ford Coppola.
That's a really good point. That's a good point. I do feel like Fury Road was made for people that like crazy over the top, you know, cars and fire and whatnot. You're right. This feels like this was made for Francis Ford Coppola and maybe like three theater students at Juilliard, right? Like this was, the appeal of this was never intended to be, this wasn't intended to be a mass market.
And that's, it's actually ironic because this movie really does kind of represent the excess of these, like, these kind of, I mean, Francis Ford Coppola is basically kind of like an untouchable millionaire at this point. He can, and this is his, like, way of saying, I can do anything I fucking want and you're going to just deal with it. Like, he'll be fine. And it's sort of, it's emblematic of us, of our country, our society, of New Rome, of, like, the excess of certain, just the amounts of wealth and, like, demonstrations of that wealth and, like, privilege and just, not giving a shit about, you know, basically, he didn't create it for an audience, like you said. He's not concerned with an audience.
You know what, and I think maybe that's one of the reasons I like this movie, because it is like so no holds barred. Like, I don't need your approval. Like, I'm an 80-year-old guy. This is the kind of thing that I'm into. I'm going to make stuff that I like. And you know what? In 5 years, I'm going to be dead and it's not going to matter to anybody, right? You know, he probably had a great time making this movie. He self-financed it. Clearly, he swung for the fences. I mean, this was, you know, I want to say his magnum opus, maybe, just because of the scope. So, you know, I guess in that sense, it's a huge success, right?
It's not every day that you watch a movie that really doesn't care what you think about it.
That's, yeah, I can think of like maybe two or three on, yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I would be a bit more friendly to it if it wasn't just so like reprehensible. It just like I get a feeling of his ideology, specifically even like about women and like the idea. We didn't finish talking about it, but like he was framed for sexual, you know, or statutory rape, right?
He was claimed. Yeah, I was reading that. They claimed.
Well, they had the doctored video from Claudio that was, you know, he played on the screens at that celebration, that marriage celebration of his father, where Veda Sweet was doing the performance, you know?
And no, he played, I don't. What part?
He like passed a USB drive to like the dudes in the back. And he played that a doctored video of Caesar and the performer having sex, and apparently was doctored. And like, obviously, you know, these rich guys are always being attacked and falsely accused of sexual assault. It never really happens, right? Like, right, that's the story you want to tell, is the false accusation.
Yeah, no, I definitely see what you're saying, and I will 100%. Qualify, you know, while this movie doesn't care what you think, it is not a good movie. Like,
no,
it's pretty crappy.
I want to go back to that idea of like, of movies that don't care what you think. Can you think of other movies that are clearly not intended for an audience?
Well, I mean, there's definitely, I think of like The Room, you know. Do you know the Room?
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah, I could see that. The one that really jumps out to me is Tom Green's movie Freddy Got Fingered. Like, that was clearly he was giving the middle finger to the studios. He was like, I'm going to make a movie that is unmarketable because F you.
That's true. He was doing a specific F you to like the romantic comedy and like the gross out comedy at the and to the studio. Like, yeah.
And that movie was horrible. It was reprehensible. It's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. But at the same time, it was, you know, from an artistic point of view, it was fantastic because it did exactly what it wanted to. I mean, it had one clear purpose, and it was to be a gross out, to turn everyone off. And it did a good job at that, right? I feel like that's sort of what this is shooting for, right? Like,
I guess, but see the difference. The difference for me is the motivation, and I think that's a valid motivation. Okay. I think like someone like Tommy Wiseau making The Room, I liken it more to him because of his narcissism. He's mostly making it as like this huge narcissist making himself the main character. I mean, Coppola basically kind of made himself the main character in several of the characters in the movie, I think. And just kind of like as this, he's like I think it demonstrates a narcissist. I don't know. So that's my slight difference. But
Doug, can you think of any other movies that clearly don't care?
I mean, initially I was kind of thinking like the Stanley Kubrick films. Like, Kubrick was way more into making the film that he wanted to make versus making a film that audiences wanted to make. But even so, I feel like he tried to keep his stuff grounded and...
Yeah.
Well, he had good taste, you know?
Yeah. He had a sense of art, I think. Right? But, I mean, a lot of his movies were more about the art than they were...
But there's some good art in this movie. Like, there's some great shots. The
majority of this movie is beautiful art. I mean, I would say 85% of this movie is gorgeous.
Yeah, there's a lot to like... So the fact that you said, Doug, this is not a good movie, that makes me, like, kind of scramble my brain of, like, what is a good movie? Right? What is a good movie? What makes a good movie?
I guess... Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, in my mind, because I separate the plot and the story and the characters in this movie from the set pieces and the art and the indulgency, right? So in my mind, that's what makes this a good movie, is the scope, right, and the art of it. But as far as the story goes and the characters go and the themes, like, yeah, it's total garbage, right? So that does that, that now you're kind of hurting my brain, because why does that make a good movie? Because maybe it's because there isn't that much really, really good art out there. It's a lot, I want to say, it's easier to tell a good story than it is to do something for 2 hours and 18 minutes that's beautiful, right? I mean,
yeah. How could a bad... Sorry, go ahead.
It is beautiful, but it is also pretentious as hell.
Yeah.
Indulgent. It's like I said before, for every good aspect of this, there is an equal and opposite negative.
I think it's like 2-1 or 1-2, you know, like for every good thing in this movie, there's two things where you're like, what? That's stupid. And yeah.
But I think it's all worth it because of dialogue like this.
Wow, where's your coat?
I waited with no coat because I knew you'd give me yours and it would be warm. Ugh. Ugh. It smells of you. Sandalwood, citrus, sweet male memories. It can still all be yours, Caesar. Me and Crassus' bank, which I'll steal so I can give it to you.
Wow. And then he says, wow.
Indeed.
Like, that's her name, but he's also saying it, like, incredulously. Like, that's kind of brilliant. I don't know.
It works on two levels.
It works on two levels, man. I wonder if this movie, what would it be like to just be totally stoned and watch this movie? Is this one of those movies like you see The Matrix, if you know you're a little fucked up, like you're like, oh, I get it now. Like, this is why, you know, whatever.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what else? Yes. What else is worth talking about in this movie? What do you think about Adam Driver's performance?
Oh, I think he was brilliant. I think he held this movie on his back. His back hurts so bad, because like how he pulled this off, the just terrible dialogue that he was able to like kind of pull off in a respectable way, or like
just laugh out loud delivering these stupid lines.
Yeah, you never thought like he was playing the part. Like he felt like he really believed the whole time. I mean, it's the dialogue is just so ridiculous that I don't know. I can't imagine any other actor being able to pull that off. I don't know.
So he's a great actor. I will give him that. Like he really does carry this.
Let me ask you guys this question, and just to put a cap on it. Yeah, 10 out of 10. He really definitely, he gave it his all. But going through the cast, who do you think improved their resume with this film? And who do you think kind of put a dent in their resume with this film?
I mean, I hate to, Adam Driver did an amazing job, but I don't feel like this is going to help his career much, because you're going to look at this. I don't know.
I don't think it makes a difference. I think you look at
his performance and you say, yeah, this guy's killing it. If you're casting and you saw him, you know, in this role, you would definitely want to hire him, right?
That's true. Okay. I could see. Yeah. I don't feel like Giancarlo Esposito really helped himself with this movie. I mean, he did an okay job. Mm-hmm. I think Aubrey Plaza knocked it out of the park, but I don't think she really needs help, because she kind of only does weird, wacky shit on her own, right? She's like the, you know, the Will Ferrell of whatever. Like, she only does stuff that she wants to that's weird, right?
Yeah. I don't know if that's like kind of the right question to ask, like, how is this film going to affect their career? But like,
all right, I might have phrased it weird, but who do you think did a good job and who do you think sucked? Okay.
I think Dustin Hoffman was underused and his character wasn't even that good. He was largely forgettable in it.
Agreed.
John Voight did a pretty passable job as a super creepy old man.
Yeah, he was great. I have some clips of him too.
I mean, who else really stands out? I mean, okay, how about the
Shia LaBeouf.
I loved him. I mean, he comes off as super creepy and lecherous, you know, and I thought mm-hmm. that was great. I think he did a really good, I mean, I'll go so far as to say Shia LaBeouf and Aubrey Plaza are by far my two favorite characters in this.
Oh, you know who else is in this?
Hmm?
Eddie Karn. Cyril Karn's mom from Andor. Catherine Hunter.
Is that who that is?
Yes. Esposito's wife is Eddie Karn from Andor.
That's Andor's mom. Oh, I knew she looked familiar.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I did like
a good job.
Yeah, she was great.
She was fine. Yeah. I like Jason Schwartzman. I think he did a good job, kind of as a, you know, a B player.
he had good drum lines,
and one of them was like the most awkward exposition he would ever have to deliver.
What about the girl that played Julia? I feel like
she's probably my least favorite character and actress. Like, she was just kind of like very two-dimensional character. Like, just kind of a nothing character, I thought.
I don't know if it was her fault or the writing, but yeah.
Yeah, it was mostly the writing, but like, she didn't really push it over the top either. I haven't seen her in much else, so I don't know her.
We're talking about Natalie Emmanuel, Game of Thrones.
Right. I haven't seen Game of Thrones.
Oh, I haven't either. So.
Oh, okay. She kind of had a big role in that.
Was she good in Game of Thrones, would you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say so. And I thought she was okay in this.
Yeah, she wasn't bad. She just didn't stand out. But that, mm-hmm. that may not be her fault, because there were so many other really big performances in this. Like, you would had to have worked really hard to stand out. What about mm-hmm. the scene at the end where, you know, they've basically poisoned Crassus and, you know, he was like, hey, what do you think of my boner? And then he shoots her with a fucking crossbow. Like, what? Like, are you serious?
The most awkward looking dollar store toy crossbow.
Yes. Yeah.
Whatever.
And also, what's Aubrey Plaza wearing? She's got this weird, like, metal, like, bikini thing on that looks, you know, like it's right out of Star Wars.
Yeah, Star Wars Princess Leia.
It does. Like, it looks like definitely. A total Princess Leia thing. And he has this weird-ass bow. And he gives her, like, 10 seconds, too. He's like, oh, what do you think of my boner? And then he slowly pulls the blanket back, and he's holding a bow. And it takes him 10 seconds to load the thing. And she just stands there. She's like, what's going to happen?
I'll outlive you.
Yeah.
That was a great scene. But like,
yeah.
What do you guys think of the ending overall? Because like, I think with a better ending, I could have been way more on the side of this movie. I don't know. What did you think about the ending?
No. It was bad.
It was pretty saccharine, right? Everybody essentially lives happily ever after. He builds his city, like they got it, the baby crawls, and then like that's it, right?
Yeah, you just see the big reveal of this Megalon utopic city is airport walkway
platforms. Right.
Basically.
Yeah. Is that the scene where he's reaching out to her and mm-hmm. she's on the airport walkway and they can't grab hands, like what?
And he's clearly kind of moving along, like, even though he's not on the platform because they didn't like time it right. And,
he doesn't understand how to hold hands with someone or like put any effort into it. Like, it just felt awkward. Oh, God.
I think overall though, the ending really made me mad because Caesar kind of gets everything he wants. He just convinces the masses and he makes his utopia and we have no like any sense that like we had any payoff of his character or any moment of his character learning anything or changing. I mean, did he learn anything? What was his arc?
He was right the whole time?
It wasn't his arc, it was our arc.
Yeah,
where
that's
we
right.
were first introduced and we saw him as a pretentious snob and someone who thought he was better than other people.
Oh.
And then we learned to understand his genius vision. And then we sided with him and we empathized with him when he was torn down and shot by the masses. Well, specifically just one guy, but one guy who represented the masses and all the evil studio executives who wouldn't fund his project. I mean, build his city.
Is that really what the, oh my God, when you explain it like that, like that is wow.
Yeah, you know, I think now that the movie told me so, yeah. I think he is a genius.
Now I feel even stupider for liking this movie because that's horrendous. Do you guys have it up? Like, fast forward to two hours and 10 minutes for like this airport runway scene. Like, watching it again, like, it's even more comically stupid. Like, it's these two people that cannot hold hands. Like,
it doesn't even go fast either.
It's going so slow.
It's an airport walkway.
And then they finally grab hands and they're so happy, like, oh, we made it work. Like, you're going 2 miles an hour.
You know, that's the biggest sin of this movie is it's actually not that creative. Like, there's some good imagery and like,
yeah,
there's some cool performances and silliness, but like, it's not creative at all. Like, this Megalon, this transportation system, could have been so much cooler. Like, you could have like stepped into a portal, and like, he could have done anything. He could literally do anything. He had the money, and he did kind of create an entire city out of CG. So like, but yeah, his imagination ended with like, yeah, airport walkway and like funny looking buildings, you know, that's it. So
cool. Great. And yeah. Good.
F this movie. Anyway. Yeah.
I didn't even, you know what, Doug, cause I didn't realize they stopped time with the baby, you know, so clearly the baby can stop time too. I didn't put that together. Well, no. I thought it was more just stylistic of the baby. You know, I was,
yeah,
I don't know. Fuck,
time,
this movie
belongs to the future, and the future is the children.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's, I really absolutely, wow, love
what an enlightening message. Yeah,
what an enlightening message. So is that what we take away from this? This movie is made by an 84-year-old guy who doesn't give a fuck anymore, and he's rich, and he just throws money at a movie because that's what he wants to do. But clearly, the future is in the children. That's the message for this, yeah, movie.
Fuck it, you figure it out.
You figured it out, yeah.
I guess so.
For the record, that final scene when they're all standing up there together, that was the last point in the movie where I wanted to see Gus pull out a box cutter.
That would have been cool. Now, that would have been a sweet ending. Just starting stabbing people. Yeah.
Well, maybe he's saving that for Megalopolis 2.
Oh, Megalopolis 2. Electric Boogaloo.
I would love it if they made a Megalopolis 2.
I have a feeling it would be much sadder and unfortunate because he's running out of wineries to sell.
He doesn't have anything left to sell. What about the after the credit sequence?
There's an after the credit sequence?
Yeah. I forgot about it. I'm just skipping through it. But it's pretty forgettable because I don't remember this.
I didn't watch this. Oh, wow.
It's not very long. I don't remember. It's stupid. It's just Julia sitting on her dad's lap and everybody's happy. What does she say? I don't have the subtitles on. But
yeah,
whatever.
That doesn't. They kiss in the backseat of a car when they get married. Okay, they got married. Okay. Fair. Let me play one more clip that is so dumb. Let's see. This is when they're having like a sexy scene, Caesar and Julia, and Caesar finds out that he, you know, they're gonna have a baby.
Let's get married.
Married? What is that? We can't get married.
Why not? Of course we can. A baby.
No, Caesar, you're an immoral pickle of your own conscience. You're already married.
You're an immoral pickle of your own conscience. Did you hear that?
Yes, that was amazing.
You're in a moral pickle of your own. Just bedroom talk there. Moral pickle.
That's what Angie and I say in bed all the time. It's, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's just great. Just a thing then. Yeah.
Not since George Lucas has dialogue felt more natural and romantic.
I hate sand. It gets everywhere. All right. So I don't know. I think we should wrap this up. It's been an hour.
Some final thoughts.
Final thoughts. I mean, I don't know what I can say that
should
I haven't
we score
said again.
It?
Yeah, I want to score it. I'm going to just power through this. I'm going to go 8 out of 10. I liked this movie for the artistry and the absurdity and the indulgency. Everything else sucked.
I'll just say, man, the freaking rating this is impossible.
This is tough.
I hated this movie, but I loved watching it. Like, I loved revisiting it. I loved researching it. I loved talking about it. I loved the dialogue. Some of these phrases I'm going to try to use in my daily life. I'm to definitely say to people,
I'm hearing a 10 out of 10 coming.
You think blank entitles you to plow through the riches of my Emersonian mind? I'm going to use that on a daily basis. And so I can't help but give it a high score. I'm going to go 9. Like, I think it's going to live with me. I'm giving it a lot of credit for it being probably long lasting. I'm going to remember it for a long time. I hate this movie. I hate the themes, like I've already discussed, but I'm giving it a freaking 9. Go, Doug.
Did you just mic drop? You're just like you got done with your review.
I'm disgusted with myself. I'm mad. I'm disgusted that I just did that. I did it.
All right. Yeah. Go ahead, Doug. Sorry.
I'm a little bit disgusted with both of you. Why are you rating it so high? Yes, it was an interesting piece of art, and a good piece of art makes you think. And this movie made me think. But what it made me think after evaluation left me to realize that it was garbage. It's just like Atlas Shrugged. Everyone thinks, oh, it's a creative, visionary, genius piece of work. No, it's someone who has rudimentary concepts and indulges in their own genius and superiority. It's garbage. It's terrible. It was hard to follow. It was hard to watch at times. It made me feel like I was working way too damn hard to keep up with what Francis Ford Coppola was trying to tell me. And then when I felt like I did get there, I realized I didn't like what he was telling me, and he should fuck off. And I don't ever want to watch this movie again.
Yes, thank you.
5 out of 10.
So 10 out of 10 is what I'm hearing.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. For God's sakes, 5.
No, I love that someone gave it a shitty score. That's good.
You know, here's what I will say. You had a good point. You know, a good art is supposed to make you think, and this definitely made me think. I can't tell you how many movies I've seen this year, probably 30. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what I watched last week, because most of the stuff I watch is totally forgettable. Like, you know what? You asked me in 10 years what I thought of Wild Robot or whatever movie I just saw. I'd be like, I don't even remember that movie. I'm going to remember this movie because it was so crazy. So in that sense, I guess it succeeded in that it made an impact on me just because it was so, so wild and so over the top and so...
Yeah, I'm going to remember The Room. Doesn't make it a good movie.
That's a good point.
That's true. That's a good point. At the end of the day, it's cool that this exists. I think it's I'm glad we had this conversation. I'm glad we made time for it. I'm happy. I'm just happy that I, like I said, I hate this movie, but yeah, I'm glad that Francis Ford Coppola is so arrogant that he did this. And so, you know.
Well, maybe the real victory is the friends we made along the way.
There you go.
There we go. Okay. Well, this has been a Hierarchy of Disagreement. And I guess we'll end there. Follow us on Patreon and email us at disagreement@hierarchy.com. Okay.
Logic Gate out.
Out.
Protect one earth, indivisible, with long life, education, and justice for all.
Utopias offer no ready-made solutions.
Well, they're not meant to offer solutions, they're meant to ask the right questions.
Yes, but utopias turn into dystopias.